with that decision, George.
Within the past week. Let's see, this news came out on July 7th, so it's only a few days old.
And Paul, the James Webb, I think that was a supersized infrared telescope, or maybe it was the predecessor to the successor to the Hubble, and I think that was going to be at Lagrange Point number 2. Is that true, Paul?
Yes, and it was going to be infrared. And, that's of course bad news. This one has been killed before. Oh, I'm trying to think of the name that they had for this crazy thing. They had another name, and that escapes me, before it became the James Webb. They brought it back to life. It was killed. They brought it back to life. It looks like it's gone again a couple of days ago. So you got to watch out for these programs. Sometimes they will make a comeback. Juno, that's what I mentioned earlier, polar orbiting a spacecraft around Jupiter. That was killed, I don't know how many years ago. And that made a comeback. Keep your fingers crossed. Sometimes they morph into other things. They become other. But this one, yeah. I mean, it was really designed just for that purpose. It was going to open up. It had a gigantic sunshade that was going to protect the. The sunshade was like half the size of a football field. It was big. And the segments, 36 individual segments, were going to open up mirror segments. They were going to be controlled similar to what they have with, the Keck telescope, except in space. Each one was going to be, have little actuators on it to adjust it. It sounds like a complicated thing to be a million miles out, so I don't know if that had anything to do with the cancellation of it. It sounds like the course is part of it. This is basically the course that's killing a lot of these projects. The space shuttle itself, every time it goes up, it's $500 million. So, I don't know. Keep your fingers crossed. Maybe it'll come back to life. Back to you, Dick.
One of the really big telescopes was called the Overwhelmingly Large Telescope, OWL. That wasn't the one that became the James Webb, is it, Paul?
I think this is going to be the Interplanetary Finder or something. I'm trying to remember it. That's what it started off as. Because they were going to take pictures of distant stars and be able to, knock out the starlight from and zoom in on the planets, that type of thing. But, they gave the, James Webb was, I think, the third administrator of NASA, and he was the one that really pushed the space program. You've had a lot of administrations that have come and gone. Eisenhower, he didn't want the manned orbiting laboratory. Kennedy came in, he started up the whole thing. Things went along fine. Reagan, he wanted the International Space Station. That came on board. Let me drop it. But a lot of things came and went. Apollo Soyuz meeting up in space. They thought that was a waste. They wanted to knock that down, and they realized it was going to be good, beneficial to have the countries actually join up in space. Look at everything that's come and gone. You've got Bush's father. When he was president, forgetting about the space program, he knocked down that super collider that they had in called the SSC thing in Texas. It's going to be like, I don't know, 50 miles around or something. Yeah, so he didn't want that. That never made a comeback. Bush, well, he did away with it. You know, everybody's knocking him because, you know, his son, because he got rid of the space shuttle. Let me drop it. But really, the space shuttle system was designed for either 100 flights each or 30 years of operation. You know, it's like whichever came first, you know. So the 100 flights each, of course, didn't work out, but the 30 years have come and gone. So, I mean, that's really all, you know, all that it was, he called it, you know. But I was hoping Obama would come back with something a little stronger than just, you know, bringing back the part of the Constellation mission, you know, without any real information. Hopefully, they say there's supposed to be a news conference after Atlantis gets back, and they're going to make some announcements. We'll see what they're going to do, Dick. Back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Let's see if we can squeeze Ray in quickly. KC2MMY, what was your question, Ray? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, KC2MMY. My question was in relation to what you were talking about before, with that, actually having a Linko, I think it's a 77DX or something, 100 watts. I'm worried about the RFI affecting the computer in my SUV. I'm running from the radio to a manual MFJ antenna tuner, and then from the antenna tuner out to the back of the car to the antenna that I have mounted actually on the chassis.
Yeah, the good news is that well-made HF rigs, the 12-volt input lead is very well bypassed. In the case of an afterburner amplifier, like a Mirage or a Tokyo High Power, there's a lot of RF energy on the 12-volt lead. But in the case of HF rigs, your 817s and things like that, that's not a problem. Therefore, with very little RF energy on the 12-volt wiring, the only other thing you got to worry about is the antenna going to be injecting RF energy into the computer, instrument panel, and so on. And now that's a function of how well you bound the coax cable, how well you ground the antenna at its point of use. Most HF antennas, the counterpoise, the grounding of the antenna takes place in the metal frame of the car. And with a good antenna installation, I don't think you're going to run into a trouble. My guess is you start asking guys who have done an installation like the one that you're proposing. I bet there's a lot of people who have done it, Mel among other people. KC2MMY, K2RIW, go ahead, Ray.
I think it's, I always forget your call. K2RIW? Well, you can tell me again. Yeah, what I do notice when I hit transmit, a couple of things go a little crazy. Not with the car itself, a little external thermometer that I glued to the dashboard starts making noises. So I know there's RFI in the car, but it doesn't seem to do anything to the car.
That's a good sign. And you could find out where the RF is coming from by a couple of not too complicated tests, Ray. You could disconnect the antenna right at the far end of the transmission line and put on a known well-shielded dummy load and transmit the same amount of power. I think you're going to find out your thermometer and the instrument panel, everything else works correctly with a dummy load. That would be pretty strong proof that nothing of the wiring from the back of the radio on the 12-volt input or the transmission line coming out of the back of the radio, none of that is giving you any grief. Then it's only the antenna itself. And there are ways of modifying the antenna. Your next test, if you did find out that the antenna was doing it but a dummy load does not, you now want to know, is the RF getting into the car coming back down on the outside of the coax cable? If so, there's ways you can choke the cable. A couple of simple turns of the coax cable, coiled together and held together with black tape where the transmission line meets the antenna, would be a pretty darn good RF choke. And there's other kinds of balancing devices you can use at that point. So step by step with a bunch of tests, you can find out where's the RF coming from, and that'll tell you where to go to make it go away. Back to you, Ray. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick.
Okay, K2 Romeo India Whiskey, KC2 MMY. Thanks for the info. Maybe some RF beads we could try. I'm just afraid to I'm fine at 50 watts, you know, but I don't get very far. I'm afraid to transmit the 100 watts. So I also just ran through the grommet of my firewall. I did find one where I could go through right behind the battery, a big rubber grommet, and I went through that with wires right to the battery, so I'm okay with that.
Do you have some fuses on both the plus and minus lead right at the battery, Ray?
The fuses, and they came on the wires, which is like, I think it's 10 gauge wire or 12 gauge wire that came with the radio. But the fuses, they fused it at the radio, not at the battery. But it's only
Yeah, the strongest recommendation is to do the fusing at the battery, because if the wire becomes chafed between the battery and the firewall, you could burn down an automobile. And the fuse that's beyond that grommet at the back of the rig, that in that case wouldn't do you much good. So you would be a little bit safer if you put a pair of fuses right at the battery. Ray, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's an additional thing I'm going to do. I definitely don't want to burn up the car. And again, it's an SUV. But you know, my antenna is mounted fairly well, but it's not conventional because it's a little it's on the I don't want it high up in the air because you hit all the garages here in Yonkers. It radiates in a circle because it's a regular stand up antenna, but it has metal close to it because it's close to the car, so the radiation's off. But I get a decent SWR.
Yeah, SWR is a necessary but not sufficient. Good SWR means you're properly impedance matching the feed line to the antenna. That's got very little to do with where does the antenna send its signal, how well is it grounded, and is it sending RF energy back down the outside of the cable. This wire doesn't tell you any of that. So, great big ferrite beads on the outside of the coax cable. That could help. Also, take the transmission line and make a few coils of it held together with black tape near the antenna. So since you've got some evidence of RF energy getting into the passenger compartment, a good guess is that it might be coming down the outside of the coax, and by choking the outside of the coax in various techniques and maybe changing the ground of the antenna, you will eventually be able to make that happen, stop happening, and you will be able to go to the higher power. Now, I'm going to change subjects. Let me drop. In our deeper discussions last week, one of the things that we got pretty heavy into is what's really going on in a coax cable. And the books do not make this clear. We know that the coax cable is a transverse electromagnetic structure. That means the RF current flowing down the semiconductor makes a magnetic field. That magnetic field is like your fingers wrapping around a wire and your thumb pointing in the direction of the current. And that magnetic field are a bunch of circles, so to speak, around the wire. And someone asked this question last week, okay, you've got a certain amount of current flowing down the wire and you have return current flowing down the shield. What about the magnetic field flowing down the shield? And that sent us into a real tizzy last week. And I suddenly realized what's going on. Every piece of coax cable has a recommended frequency region where you're supposed to use it. Every piece of coax cable has an upper cutoff frequency where you're not supposed to go beyond and use it. Why is that? It's the waveguide beyond cutoff phenomenon. If I had a piece of rectangular waveguide or round waveguide, almost doesn't matter. But if the major dimension of the waveguide is not in the vicinity of one half wavelength. In the case of a rectangular guide, it's exactly half wavelength. In the case of a circular waveguide, it's a slightly different formula. But if you don't have a single dimension of the waveguide that's not half wavelength approximately or more, the signal will not go down there. When I say not go down there, let me make that a little bit more clear. the signal will not go down there, meaning that you can have a kilowatt signal that you're trying to launch down that piece of waveguide. And you go a couple of inches down the waveguide, and the signal will be suppressed by 60 decibels per couple of inches. 1 millionth of the power goes a couple of inches down the guide, and the next couple of inches gives you another 60 dB of attenuation. The world's sharpest, most severe high-pass filter is waveguide. There's a whole series of so-called evanescent filters that use this phenomenon of waveguide. It is the world's sharpest, most severe high-pass filter. You go below that so-called cutoff frequency, and you cannot launch a signal. So here's my outer sheath of my semi-rigid, let's assume now I've got a piece of hardline coax cable in my example. And I'm using it at, say, 400 megacycles, 432 megacycles. Without that semiconductor, I can launch no signal down that cable. When I put the center conductor down the cable, it makes an extremely minor extra capacitance between the upper 12 o'clock point and the 6 o'clock point on the cable when you're looking at it in cross-section, and as such, the cutoff frequency moves down a little bit because of the center conductor, but still the same phenomenon is there. The waveguide mode of the outer conductor of this hardline will not allow you to send down a signal. Only when you go to beyond the so-called recommended frequency for the coax cable, now you can launch the waveguide mode as well as the coax mode simultaneously. And when you do that, all kinds of funny things start happening. Let me drop. Now you've got two different modes of propagation. The coaxial cable mode moves at very close to the speed of light if it was airline. The waveguide mode has a group velocity that's quite a bit slower. Maybe it's like 70%. So because you've got two methods of sending the signal down, and they have two different speeds of propagation, as you go down that cable, those two different modes on the forward flowing signal with no viswalk, you've got a perfect termination at the end of the cable. And you've got these two different modes because you're up at so high a frequency, you're beyond the maximum frequency of recommended use of the cable. Now you look at the forward going signal and you'll find peaks and valleys because there are places where the two modes are in phase, the two modes are out of phase, and this is only forward flowing modes. Crazy. Been there, done that, seen that. And if you're a smart enough hand, you could use that to your advantage. Choose the right length of cable and the right way of feeding it so that the two modes come out in phase at your antenna, and you got a little bit lower loss for that particular frequency. But when you're at the recommended frequency, the waveguide mode will not propagate. As such, there is no voltage differences across that outer coax cable, the outer conductor. If you try to measure the transverse voltage from the 12 o'clock point to the 6 o'clock point, it's always 0 volts. If you try to measure the voltage on the outer conductor, inner surface, in the Z direction, it's always 0 volts. You cannot launch a signal. So even though you think you've got a return current, when you're using it in the TEM coax mode, all of your power is on the center conductor. All of your power is between center conductor and, let's say, the polyethylene, between that
repeater, timeout, cancel.
On the center conductor, inside the polyethylene, between the center conductor and the outer conductor inner surface, all of the power is on the center conductor. There is no energy, per se, on the outer conductor. You're about to say, what about the return current? Well, let's talk about that. I can have continuous return current, which doesn't add up to anything. If I stop time and I stop that wave traveling down the coax cable, at this particular point in the cable, the center conductor is positive. Halfway further down, the voltage is negative. The capacitive effect of that voltage between positive and outer is giving me a certain local current at the positive area. Halfway went downrange, I'm getting the opposite sense of current. It's in the opposite direction because the voltage is opposite. But the sum, the total sum of zero. There is no signal on the outer conductor. Another way of describing why we keep pulling coax cable, an unbalanced structure. Used properly, there is no signal on the outside of the outer conductor. Even on the inside surface of the outer conductor, there is no signal, no voltage drop, no matter how you want to measure it. All the energy is on the center conductor because of the waveguide phenomenon. I'm proposing that as a method of explanation. I haven't read it anywhere, but from the evidence I've seen, so far it fits. You guys may have some questions on this one. I'll turn it over to John first, because I think he's the guy who originally brought up the question 3 weeks ago. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
End question.
Wesley recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
Very good explanation, Dick. I love it. But now, why do we need the shield? What purpose does it serve?
Without the shield, the semiconductor is an antenna. Obvious by the fact that, let's assume I've got a real half-wave dipole. I'm feeding it with twin lead. I got 72-ohm twin lead coming up to the center of a half-wave dipole. And the half-wave dipole has an impedance of 72 ohms. I'm feeding it with 72-ohm twin lead. And I've now got signal bouncing back and forth on that dipole, and I'm radiating into space. All of a sudden, I come along and decide to build the dipole out of coax cable instead of wire. So I leave the outer conductor on the center conductor. I drill two little holes where I bring in the twin lead to feed the center conductor. And I made a gap in the center conductor in the center of the dipole. And I chopped off the dipole a quarter wavelength to the right and a quarter wavelength to the left of the center. I've now got a thoroughly shielded dipole because I've left on the outer conductor. You do that, and I know somebody who's run that experiment. Guess what happens? The signal has got the exact same velocity of propagation if you set the coax cable the right length for your shielded dipole. The signal is bouncing back and forth what looks like the exact same way. You measure the voltage versus position on that center conductor. Everything's the same as far as the dipole function is concerned. But the impedance you'll measure at the center on your twin lead will be 0 ohms. Because the signal goes down the right-hand side of the dipole, it's a quarter wavelength long, hits the open circuit, reflects back, comes back to the center, half wavelength delayed in time. By then, the signal coming out of the transmitter has gone a half wavelength in time. It's got the opposite polarity. So I got 1 volt going out. I got 1 volt coming back. But now the transmitter is putting out -1 volt. It comes back and sees a direct short circuit. None of that signal got radiated. So it comes back at the exact same voltage, and you get a perfect cancel.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oh, you've now made a thoroughly shielded dipole. The impedance, if you did it out of low-loss materials, went to 0 ohms. It does not radiate. So the semiconductor by itself is a beautiful radiator. Put this beautiful shield on the outside, which has no signal on it, but it still does this beautiful job of shielding. It stops the radiation. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Its only usefulness is the fact that it's shielding. Other than that, it's not being used. Interesting concept. Love it. I just pick up Wesley.
You've got it. All the energy's on the center conductor. Wait for the beep, and you got it, Wes. K2RIW.
Enter Jim. Good evening, good buddy. But the subject is more complicated than it looks like it is. The part of that what is happening on the coaxial cable is related to the subject that I sent you the questions for, which is the mechanical properties of the electron. And we have in the outer shield, in the braid of the coaxial cable, few effects. One of them is the transformer effect, and is sometimes used to mitigate the effect of the current induced in the shield. The inner and outer conductors form the primary and the secondary winding of the transformer, and the effect is enhanced in some high quantity cables were, that have a outer layer of multi-metal, but because there is a one-to-one transformer, the voltage across the outer conductor is transformed onto, into the inner conductor. So, the two voltages can be canceled by the receiver, but in practice, at a certain frequency is not happening. So, many sender and receivers have means to reduce the leakage or the effect of the, of that phenomenon. And they increase the transformer effect by passing the whole cable through the ferrite core sometimes in several times. And this is being called balloon. So, deeper into the subject, it is a vibration of the copper wire due to the current that is flowing into it. And I have a number of the evidence.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Okay, you are speculating that the mechanical motion of the electrons is creating an acoustical effect. And we got a problem with that one. Remember, the electron flowing out of the battery of my automobile, when the starter motor is drawing 200 amperes, it takes 4 hours for that electron to get to the starter motor. The total motion velocity, average velocity, I better call it speed. The average speed, because it's jumping all over, but the conglomerate group velocity, let's call it speed, is extremely small. Without a doubt, I think I've heard you earlier in the week talk about the fact that when you put your hands on your fuse box at your house, you hear a humming sound. And you've speculated that the electrons flowing through the copper are doing that. I'll admit it looks that way. I don't think so. I really don't think so. When it comes to magnetostrictive effects, in other words, if I've got nickel, for instance, when you make an ultrasonic transducer, an ultrasonic cleaning device, they take these nickel rods and they wrap a coil around them, and the nickel rods are attached to the bottom of a metal container, and the metal container is going to move up and down like a diaphragm, the bottom of it, and the nickel rod, as you put a stronger and weaker magnetic field, the nickel rod changes its dimension. That's called the magnetostriction effect. So in the case of ferromagnetic materials, nickel is one of them, iron is another one. Right. You've seen the hum you get out of a power transformer. Let me drop. So when you create a magnetic field in ferromagnetic materials, you do get a dimensional change of the material. And that's like an earphone, a loudspeaker, whatever. So you do get a real mechanical effect from current flowing into a coil, a solenoid coil, creating a magnetic field around ferromagnetic materials. Another thing that's going on in the case of your fuse box. Your fuse box usually has a pretty heavy piece of conduit that goes from the fuse box up a couple of feet through the wall into the watt-hour meter. The watt-hour meter is a magnetic device. It is taking the instantaneous voltage, the instantaneous current, multiplying the two together, and that determines the rate of rotation of a wheel, and that wheel with a bunch of gears eventually moves some dials in the old-fashioned mechanical one, and that tells you how many watt-hours you've consumed and how many dollars you owe to Con Edison. But that is a transformer-like magnetic device. On top of that, your circuit breakers work by magnetics. The magnetic field created in the current flowing through your circuit breaker is what pulls in the armature that trips the circuit breaker. So inside your fuse box, inside your fuse panel of your house, you got a bunch of circuit breakers that are magnetic, and you got this heavy piece of conduit connected to the watt-hour meter on the outside. One of those, or the combination of those, is making your fuse panel vibrate. I don't think it's the current flowing through the copper wires that's making the vibration.
Well, let me suppose it.
That's my guess, but go ahead, Wes, and wait for a beep.
Well, let's start from the beginning. The air core inductor, it is the one that is not made of the ferromagnetic material, and the term air core refers to the coil wound on the plastic or ceramic or non-magnetic forms, as well as those having air inside the windings, whatever. Now, a side effect that can occur in the air core, I pointed air core coils, in which the winding is not rigidly supported on the form, is a microphony. Mechanical vibration on the winding cause and the vibration in the inductance. Let me drop and I go to another example.
I'll stop right there. You got a good one. Let me drop. If you wind a solenoid coil in air, you will get mechanical motion when current flows through that solenoid. That's because the coil is making a magnetic field. The magnetic field has a bucking magnetic field effect. Lenz's law, I think it is. So, in other words, the coil itself is generating a magnetic field. The magnetic field, in turn, is generating a back EMF voltage on that coil. So, the coil does have, that's not magnetostriction. It is now, let's call it the loudspeaker effect or the earphone effect. So a coil, a solenoid coil with no magnetic materials around, yes, that will create mechanical motion. But that's due to the magnetic field. And by the same token, if I've got two parallel wires carrying a very heavy current, and they're side by side, and now you put enough current through those wires so that they are beginning to melt. Depending on whether or not the current is flowing in the same direction through the two wires or in opposite directions, those two wires as they melt will either push apart or pull together. In fact, that's the way you measure the CGS technique or the MKS technique. By the MKS definition of magnetic field, it is the amount of force that you create between two parallel wires that are carrying a known amount of current. So magnetics flowing through wires will give you a force-generating effect.
The problem is that we're dealing with one singular coil only. There is no transformer, and it's vibrating.
I agree. One solenoid coil will vibrate because of the bucking magnetic field that solenoid coil is creating.
But another example. The vibrating wires in the mining or civil or hydrological engineering and other geophysical disciplines. As you know, I was heavily involved in this field for a number of years. There was a special type of the equipment that was developed, known as under the name geologgers, that generates a current pulse to excite a plunk the wire in the vibrating wire gauge. Immediately following the excitation, the resonance frequency of the vibrating wire is being measured. So the advantage of the plunking pulse method is that fixed pulse is able to simulate a wide range of the gauges, and this greatly simplifies the ability to measure the vibration. But there is another one. Kaplan cables. A short piece of cable that is usually used in not very big currents, and a special attention was made to damping mechanical vibration in which each one of the conductors in within the wire by the spacing material between the conductors providing additional damping. Another one, let me jump. The scientific paper, Journal of Physics and Applied Physics, Volume 34, Number 10. The experiment shown that the wires break in tension due to the long
longitudinal forces of unknown nature. In other words, is the scientists went deep into that, and they found that the previous theoretical and numerical investigation served to provide a search for these forces and have identified the pinch effect of the thermal expansions as the source of the strong longitudinal vibrations is unknown in nature. But the mechanism does not give the satisfactory explanation for the phenomenon in the ways which they have clamped in. So the investigation was using a simplified magneto-thermoelastic model to study this vibration induced by high pulse currents in the wires. And not a moment that we have a microwave. We have a vibration by pulsing. Let me jump. By reading this scientific paper, I came to the conclusion that if the scientists found unknown nature of this phenomenon, that must be due to something. That's why I created all this speculation. And I prepare myself. Now, the skin effect. At 60 Hertz in the copper, the skin effect is about 8.5 millimeters. At a high frequency, the skin effect depth might be much smaller. Increased AC resistance due to the skin effect can be mitigated by using a specially made a valence-less wire. Because the interior of the large conductor carries a little of the current, the tubular conductor, such as pipe, can be used to save weight and cost. Here's the point. John mentioned once, and he was hesitating then to just stand on it because he was, I don't know if it really happened or didn't happen. And I would like John just to give the relation of that, what he observed in the pipes. So, John, if you can pick up.
Dick, maybe you want to make some comments first?
As you have currents and voltages on various conductors, and you worry about mechanical motion that's taking place, I know of two phenomena that will give you mechanical motion: electrostatic attraction and magnetic repulsion or attraction, or electrostatic repulsion. So electrostatic attraction or repulsion, magnetic attraction or repulsion. So as I've got current and voltages flowing on conductors, and these are now copper conductors, depending on how I arrange things, I can make mechanical motion from electrostatics, and I can make mechanical motion because of magnetics. But when you really look at the real speed, average speed of electrons, because the charge of an electron is so extremely large compared to its mass. Its mass is very small, its charge is very large. So the charge phenomena, the electrostatic attraction and repulsion, that dominates. You and I could easily speculate that the motion of the electrons is creating the mechanical energy that we see. My first guess is it's going to be electrostatic and magnetic. And the electrons themselves, I think if you wanted to really measure the acceleration and deceleration of the electrons and the force that that creates independent of the other two, I think with laboratory equipment, it would be very difficult to measure it. I think the force of acceleration and deceleration of electrons, I believe it's very small.
Supporting material for that, but I'm waiting for John just to make a comment.
And there's one exception to that, and that is when you make an electron gun on a cathode ray tube and you put 30,000 volts on it and you accelerate those electrons at the, I'm going to pick a number, 2/3 the speed of light, and you slam them into that phosphor coating on the front end of the picture tube and you get light output. With that extremely high velocity of those electrons, I think you could then, they're going through air, very high acceleration through air. And now I think you could measure some mechanical force out of that. But if that's those exact same electrons were traveling through a wire, that went from the electron gun assembly up to the face of the tube. For the exact same amount of current, it would take a week for those electrons to get there. And therefore the mechanical motion would be millions of times smaller than it is when the electrons are lighting up the phosphor. That's a guess on my part. But tell us about your pipe experiment, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Pleasure, Dick. Before I forget, I do have an atomic modeling question for you, if we have time. But what happened with us, as you know, circuit breakers, they have anticipators and things. I would notice that on large current devices, you're always going to get some lamination hums or some strange things like that. But when we would have a direct fault on a heavy cable, even small wires, it happens, it would rattle the pipe. And my impression of that is the magnetic field that was being set up by the copper wire, that pipe, the copper wire was actually bouncing around in the pipe. And that's due to the magnetic effect. Wesley was thinking it was possibly the electrons that were causing that. It's the magnetic field, I believe. Also, he had asked me about an experiment, which I've never tried, but you alluded to it a few minutes ago. Just a piece of pipe, like a piece of EMT on a bench, if we pulled heavy current through it, would it vibrate? That I'm not sure of.
Yeah, I've got a guess as to what could be happening with those wires rattling in your pipe. What you called a pipe, I'm going to guess, was a piece of conduit there for safety reasons. And the heavy current you're talking about, I am guessing you had a forward and return wire going through the pipe. And as such, you have two leads inside of the conduit, the so-called pipe, with tremendous amounts of short circuit current flowing in two opposite directions. And I keep forgetting, do they attract or repel, but in either case, the two wires have an extremely heavy, magnetically caused force between two parallel wires that are carrying a heavy current. That is the method by which you measure the amount of magnetic field. How much force do you get when a known amount of current is flowing through two wires that are parallel to each other? That is the way that the National Bureau of Standards rates the magnitude of a magnetic field. So those two wires in that pipe with that short circuit are either heavily attracting or heavily repelling each other, and therefore they're slamming up against the sides of that pipe, and I think that's the rattling that you heard during a short circuit, and I think it's purely magnetic for the most part. That's my guess, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, that's what I've always believed. It happened many times. There would be many times where we would have a 4,000 amp fault at 13.8 or 4160, and let me tell you, those wires would make a lot of noise. But you can hear the same thing with number 10 wires in a piece of EMT. If you have a short, say, a 30 amp breaker, those wires will jump around before that breaker trips usually. But interesting, but you confirmed what I thought.
Now, once again, anybody who's listened to our introduction, you're hearing a bunch of guys who are very fascinated as to what's happening at the molecular level, at the atomic level. You're really listening to the sound of the blind leading the blind. I don't think any of us here are even slightly expert in this area. But by way of us making it public domain, by this TechNet being listened to by quite a few people, in many cases quite a few states, in many cases quite a few countries, all of it being recorded on the www.amateurradio.tangovictor by Mike Perry's website, all of it's being recorded, and people can play it back and therefore agree or disagree with it and write us emails or get on the air and tell us how wrong we are. You could say it eventually becomes peer-reviewed material. We don't guarantee 100% accuracy. We can't. Nobody does. Nobody bats 1,000. We all have a certain error rate. And some of the things you're hearing at first may not be accurate. What I'm claiming is that when Mel and Dick and Wesley and John and Glenn and Eric and Alex, wait a minute, Andy, the guys, and Rich, EO, and Barry, and 2MB, the guys who are really enthusiastic about all this. When the smoke finally settles, and we all settle on an answer that is quasi-peer reviewed, we have reason to believe that most of the time, we eventually arrive at a higher truth, it says here. That's what we're seeking. Want to know, Mother Nature is giving us a very complicated story that we're reading and try to understand it. We're trying to find out what's really happening here. We want to know.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Inquiring minds want to know. That's what you're hearing. So, no guarantees, but we think we're slowly arriving at a higher truth. So, when it comes to electrons flowing through a wire, creating mechanical energy directly, I'm expressing quite a bit of pushback on that. I'm expressing quite a bit of skepticism. Because by the time I've got enough electrons moving that I'm getting a significant current, and by definition that current will always make a significant magnetic field, and now those opposing or aiding magnetic fields create all kinds of crazy forces in between each other, it is my guess that the majority of the time the phenomenon we're talking about is magnetic and occasionally electrostatic. Electrostatic attraction and electrostatic repulsion. But the electron velocity acceleration mechanics, I think, is a tertiary effect at best. That's my guess. And in the next few weeks, we may be able to confirm that. So we're having a little bit of pushback on your speculation on that one. The evidence that you've seen, Wesley, easily can be read that way. But for the time being, I think there's another explanation that may be a lot more dominant. N2XJN, K2RIW.
WH4YY.
Joe recognized? Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I wonder if KE2EJ was on channel. I just want to ask if he knows about the condition of channel 21. I'm barely getting the signal out here if he's doing something with the transmitter.
Yeah, and I also want to ask him, and you, when I look at 11-3 and 11-4, nothing is there. I get 11-1 and 11-2. 11-1 is normal channel 11, and 11-2 is Australia TV. But there is no 11-3 or 11-4 on any mechanism by which I can power up my converter. And yet you've told me there is an 11-3 and 11-4 channel, and I'm wondering why I'm not getting it. Let's see if Eric is around. KE2EJ, we'd love to hear from our broadcast engineer, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric, if you're there. We might not have Eric on board tonight. Back to you, Joe.
Okay. Well, I got my house antenna pointed about 330 degrees, and I could barely get channel 21 from Plainview, so something definitely is going on.
And if so, if he's had a power failure or whatever, he may be up to his waist in alligators, if you know what I mean, and therefore he hasn't got time to talk to us. That's a guess on my part. If I get a chance, I'm going to go see if I got channel 21 playing. Wesley, so as you can see, you're hearing my first speculations as to what I'm thinking. So electron mechanics, I think, is an extremely minor effect in copper, is my guess, Wes. N2XJN?
About 11-3, WS2N.
You got an 11-3. Let's have that again, Paul.
Yeah, 11-3 is this TV, and 11-4 is antenna TV. T5 copy, I mean, really good.
Wow. Then why is my Radio Shack not sending that to me? When I go to the manual mode and I try to...
He has to do a rescan.
Yeah, but if I do a rescan, I'm going to lose a hell of a lot of the stuff that I've already got if it's not there during the scan time. I wish the machine would allow me to rescan and not erase the stuff that's not there in that instant. I don't think Radio Shack Converter will let me do that. Over to you, Joe.
Your converter does not have something called Easy Add available on it, because the Insignia converters definitely do have that. It has auto add, which will completely erase everything and start over, or it has easy add, which allows you to add to your existing list of channels without erasing other ones.
Okay, I'm going to have to dig a little bit deeper into the manual and find out what's going on, whether or not I've got it. Okay, now there's something to look for. One more standby to see if Eric is available. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
By the way, Dick, Antenna TV has a lot of old sitcom type of things, and this TV has a lot of old movies, and, you know, pretty good. This TV is very good. In fact, I recorded something earlier today, two-hour movie back to you there.
Yeah, nostalgia type stuff. I'd love to see that. What's the name of that other channel, that TV Classics, American Movie Classics, AMC? Yeah, that's it. So it's got AMC-like material. Is that what you're saying, Paul?
I guess, I guess it would be along those lines, but, probably not as popular movies as maybe AMC would have. Maybe Turner Classic Movies, I don't know about that. They have a lot of real, like old black and white movies. But, this TV is good. It came out, I think, only a year or two ago in the New York area. It started from San Francisco and went all the way through, the CW network. Channel 11. So maybe when you scan that originally, this TV wasn't up yet.
Dick, with your permission, I would like to come back to the subject.
Yeah, go ahead. And so, as you can tell, Wes, I'm speculating that the mechanics of the electrons are extremely minor. But magnetics and electrostatics, yeah, that's major. How about you, Wes?
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Dick. And to XGN. Well, if we analyze the atomic orbital, it does have mechanical properties. The electron has no known substructure, and it is identified or assumed to be a point particle, which with the point charge and no spatial extent. But the observation of the single electron there was a panning trap, the experiment that was shown, shows that the upper limit of the particle radius is 10 to minus 20 seconds of the meter. So the physical construct is called classical electron radius. So now we know that the electron does have at least the properties, mechanical properties. So the terminology, we can go to the simplistic calculation that ignores the effect of quantum mechanics. It is being called a classical electron radius, and we may say that we have the electron that is moving around the nucleus, but here's the problem. If we analyze and look close into the orbitals and the orbits, we may take the comparison. So let's say the planet moves around the sun, you can plot it, divide the parts, but in which one of the parts is being called the orbit. But when you look at the atom, it looks like we have something similar that we may have picture. The electrons are the orbiting around the nucleus. The truth is different, and the electrons, in fact, inhabit the regions of space which are known as the orbitals. There is a certain impossibility of drawing the orbits of electrons. The plot of the path is needed exactly to know where the object is. And the reason for that is because the electron can move within the orbital pattern. And if we take a look at the hydrogen electron, it does have a 32 different levels. That means it could jump up and jump up and jump up. So
try to take that particular atom and plot the position of the electron, soon afterwards, we came to the point that we have no idea how to do it and where that electron is. And we try to go over and over again. We'll try to build some kind of three-dimensional map and place the electron in it. And in terms of the hydrogen case, the electron can be found anywhere within the spherical space surrounding the nucleus. So, we're talking about, at first, the vector, the circular vector of the motion of the electron. Then we're talking about the force that is holding electrons close to the nucleus. Then we're talking about the pulling vector out when the when this electron is attracted by the energy from outside. And then we're talking about self, how to call it, self increasing speed. I'm missing the word. Accelerating, self accelerating force due to the amount of energy that is this electron is influencing it, and of course changing the speed. Now, all of this is like we try to find out what was the first, a chicken or the egg. It doesn't matter. The matter is that the electron, by its own existence, is the origin that leads you to the electromagnetic fields, leads you to all of the phenomena that happens later. So, how can then we claim, in the philosophical terms, that electron and the magnetic properties of electron has little or nothing to do with a vibration of the wire? Back to you, Dick, and to Adrian.
I'm going to first use as a model a satellite in orbit around the Earth, and then I'm going to try to relate it to an electron going around a nucleus inside of an atom. Low Earth orbit, an object is a couple hundred nautical miles above the surface of the Earth, roughly 4,000 miles of radius from the center of the Earth, and the object moves at roughly 17,500 miles an hour. So right now, the space shuttle is moving close to 17,500 miles an hour, and it's something like 220 nautical miles above the surface of the Earth. If he launched a satellite, and you and I wanted that satellite to be in geosynchronous orbit, we don't want it to be 200 miles above the surface of the Earth, we want it to be 22,000 miles above the surface of the Earth. I have to use an apogee kick motor, and I put a lot more energy into that satellite, and with at least a two-burn maneuver, a Holloman maneuver, I eventually get it at 22,000 miles of radius of its orbit. I've now got it in geosynchronous altitude. Let me drop. And the crazy thing about that is it's got a lot more energy now. I put it at a much higher orbit. It's got a lot more energy. But it's only moving 6,000 miles an hour. That's the crazy part. When you've got a larger diameter orbit, you can maintain that orbit at a lower velocity, but the total amount of energy you put into it is greater. I know that sounds like a paradox. And I think the exact same thing happens with an electron going around a nucleus, around a bunch of protons, that more energy exists in that electron orbit when you excite it to a higher orbital radius, but I think it moves slower when it's up there. Because in each case, it's a inverse square law of the restoring force. Gravity obeys an inverse square law. In other words, the amount of gravity, the gravitational force that my satellite around the Earth senses is a function of the square of the distance between the satellite and the center of the Earth. The electrostatic attraction between the protons in a nucleus and the electron that's in orbit around it, again, is a square law phenomenon. So I believe the electron is moving slower when it's in a higher orbit, but it's got more total energy. You have to